Welcome to Board Game Famous, the board game podcast that chronicles two brothers and some friends on their way to board game fame. I'm your host, David, and I'm joined, as always, with my co-host, Jesse.
Hey, y'all!
That's right, Michael's gallivanting off in Japan right now, so it's just Jesse and I.
Isn't that a game? Let's go to Japan.
It is. I've been watching reviews while Michael's there. I've been meaning to send them to him.
Wonder if he's playing it in a board game cafe over there.
Well, anyway, we start as always with, hey, Jesse, what you been playing?
Well, I've been on spring break this week, so I've gotten to play a lot of board games and got some new games to the table. But this week, I want to talk about a game I've been playing all by myself, because Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs finally arrived recently, and I have been playing the goodness out of it. Now, little spoiler for the listeners at home, not about the game, but about the pod. We recorded this conversation once before, and due to technical difficulties, we lost it, so we're re-recording. So the first time I talked about the game, I had been having some major difficulties and struggling, but I got past them, and life is good. Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs is a solo-only game that was released in 2024. It was designed by Joe Klipfel and Nikki Valens and published by Cephalofair Games. In this game, you play as one of the original six characters from Gloomhaven, one of the starter classes, and you have been shrunk down, so you are a teeny tiny itty bitty version of yourself, and you are trying to solve your way through some kind of puzzle dungeons in which you best some baddies who have also been scaled down appropriately to size with you. The box for this game is so little and so cute. I love that it's shaped like the original Gloomhaven box, and it has so much in a tiny package. It's got, I think, 22 scenarios, and it seems like each class has their own special, unique scenario they get to play that none of the others do. I've been playing through the game as the Mind Thief, and it's been a lot of fun. That was my starter class when I played in Gloomhaven. I like it because it gets to manipulate enemies and send them onto traps and things like that. It's definitely in my playstyle. In general, it's been a lot of fun. This is a game in which you are making choices based on cards that you have. Each character gets four double-sided cards, and when you use one side of the card, they flip to the other, and then they get discarded. And it's all about effectively managing your hand so that you can survive long enough to kill the baddies. David, I know you've been playing this game too, so want to chime in with any of your thoughts about it?
I love this game. When we were talking about this during our last recording of this, I called this a triumph of game design. Shrinking down Gloomhaven to a box this size, and in a game that works, is absolutely incredible to me. I absolutely love Gloomhaven. I think everybody on this podcast is big Gloomhaven fanboys. So I backed this immediately. I didn't even read anything about it, really. I was like, oh, it's tiny Gloomhaven. Let's give it a shot. The amount of rules in Gloomhaven that they managed to fit into this box is incredible. And it's also one of the number one complaints about this game. It is a miniature version of Gloomhaven, so they don't include the full rules to this game in the box. That's something you have to look up online. As somebody who is a huge fan of the original series, who taught it to numerous players, I knew the game backwards and forwards. I know how to play Gloomhaven. And to me, Buttons and Bugs is no problem. To the wider populace, it is this tiny little game that has a 40 to 50 page rule book that I essentially have memorized at this point, because the rules are very intuitive, and Buttons and Bugs plays almost exactly like Gloomhaven, and I love it. Part of the hype for getting hyped for this game. I did watch a couple of reviews on this, so I watched the Dice Tower's take on Buttons and Bugs, and I think one of the casts there mentioned something that I thought was really apt. It kind of feels like those chess solo strategies, those chess puzzles where you try and figure your way out of that. For me, Buttons and Bugs feels like I got trapped in a room by myself while my party is going off trying to get a treasure chest while I'm trying to further the main mission, and I love it. If you love Gloomhaven for the story, this isn't it. There's a smaller storyline in this one. It's like you said, only like 22 scenarios.
It got shrunk to
what? it got shrunk to blaze through like what, 15, something like that, 15 or 16.
Yeah.
And it's weaker, but I was never here for the story. I was always here for the combat, which you need to be if you want to like this game, because I did peek through the scenarios ahead of me. Cause I'm only on scenario 6 right now. I did peek through, and almost every single one of them is defeat all the enemies. So if that's not your cup of tea, this game isn't for you. But that's why I loved Gloomhaven, and this is my cup of tea. What do you think about the changes they had to make to reduce the number of components for Gloomhaven?
I think they did pretty well with it. It's crazy how much they packed into that little box. There are each scenario is printed on a single, like, standard-sized card. So on the front is, like, the little story and what happens when you finish, and also items you get to your collection when you finish. And on the back is, like, the map that you're playing on. And monsters are represented by little colored cubes, and they have little colored health dials that match the color of the cube. And they have monster stat cards. Each monster has 3 different things it can do on its turn, which is determined by the roll of a die. There's a 6-sided die that has pluses, minuses, and zeros on it, and what you roll for the monster at the start of its turn determines when it acts and what it does. In general, they have like a fast, weak move, and a medium, medium move, and a slow, stronger move. So kind of like the monster ability decks in Big Gloomhaven. As a character, you have your own cards that set your initiative and determine when you act, and I think a lot of those cards echo the cards from the original game. As you level up through the later scenarios, you get to choose cards to directly level up and improve, which is a cool mechanic. I like that you can switch them between scenarios, like you're not locked in once you've chosen a card. And that, I've found, has been really important as you play some of the later scenarios. Choosing the right level 2 card at a mid-level difficulty adventure is essential to success, is what I've found. I have played the game 20 times, 10 successes and 10 failures.
You're about at my win rate right now.
Yes, but here's the thing, David. 8 of those failures were on a single mission. I played scenario 5 9 times, and I was completely stuck on it as of the previous recording. And David suggested to me, hey, why don't you drop down the difficulty to easy, which I knew I could do, but I didn't even think about. Like, I knew there was a way to do that, and I just missed that I could do it in my mind. The only thing that it changes when you switch the scenario to easy or very easy is the monster's rolls, like their modifier table. So it didn't make a huge, huge difference, but it did allow me finally, after switching down to easy twice and then very easy twice, to defeat the first kind of mini boss, which I have read many, many people online saying is too hard. I am not going to say anything about the balance or the playtesting. I know that the designer defended adamantly that it had been playtested thoroughly and that people defeated that mission with every class on very hard mode, and I believe them, but I don't think I could do it. I think I've worked my butt off to beat it on very, very easy. So other than that one scenario, though, almost all my scenarios have been first-time wins. I've had a couple that I lost because of bad die rolls, and one that I lost because I made a poor choice in what cards I was using, and that caused me to lose a turn. But in general, I feel like I've been playing effectively. I'm playing the Mind Thief, which is a medium complexity character. The other characters there are 3 that are considered easy complexity and 2 that are considered hard complexity. I don't think that I'm going to go back through and play through all of them, although I am curious about the unique missions that each character gets. I really loved the Mind Thief's unique mission. It really focused on using mind control to manipulate the enemies and to be clever. I thought that was a lot of fun. The storyline is fine. The gameplay is quick. It's easy. There is a lot of management. If you have played Gloomhaven, you know that it takes a lot to keep the monster AI on track, and this is no different. I find myself making mistakes and missing little details all the time. But David, I think you can speak more about how that happened.
Yeah, somebody, like I said, I I've taught Gloomhaven to a ton of people, and one of the side effects of that is I usually take on a lot of the admin of the game. So that is something you need to take into account, is that there is a lot of admin in this game. You have dice you're rolling to make sure that your monsters are... So you're determining your monster's initiative. You have, instead of a combat deck, you now have a combat table that you roll the die to determine what hits on that table, and then you need to step down through that table. That's actually the part that I missed the most, because that wasn't in original Gloomhaven. That's not something I think about, is stepping through that combat table. Which, the phrase combat table is a little alarming, I think, to a lot of people, because it's so easy to flip cards off a deck. And they're trying to replicate that with this combat table that you upgrade as you level up. And I think it's interesting. It has some interesting side effects as well. My favorite side effect being... there is a critical miss on this combat table, as if there would be in your combat deck. So you can know when you're not on that critical miss, and you can risk a major heavy attack because you know you're never going to hit that critical miss this time.
Absolutely. I definitely use that to my advantage with the times two as well. You have the critical hit where you double your damage, and you can kind of plan for, okay, I have a chance at that, and if you've brought the right item with you, you can give yourself advantage, so you can, not guarantee, but give yourself a pretty good chance of hitting the monster with a crit. And that's been important, because the Mind Thief does not do a lot of damage directly. I also finally understand one of my cards and how powerful it is. It is a card that stays in play as long as you leave it in play, which, you know, you can't leave cards in play for too long in this game, because you run out of cards. But it gives me shield and retaliate, and it's super, super useful against certain monsters.
Yeah, you're talking about you can't leave them in play too long. You only have 4 double-sided cards. As a side effect of that, each player only has 9 turns to complete a scenario. Instead of having different size hands between the characters, everybody has 4. You have exactly 9 turns, unless you have to discard cards to avoid damage or use a powerful ability that makes you lose a card. I used a lose a card way too early in a scenario, and it effectively eliminated 2 turns, and I lost that. I lost that scenario because I didn't have enough time. So to me, I feel like the lose cards, you really have to know when to use them, because if you use them too early, you're going to be out of the game.
Yeah, I did that when I played the first scenario. I played through the first scenario as the Bruiser, because that's what the Dized tutorial requires. There's a really nice how to play tutorial on Dized, which I had not used before, and it was super cool. It walked me right through the first game. It was very easy to follow. Playing as the Bruiser was fun and simple, and it was just like super, super quick experience. And then I decided I could keep going as Bruiser. I wanted to play Mind Thief. Like, that's my jam.
It hurts that you say the Bruiser's on easy mode, basically. Even though it's true, it is one of the easy characters. I have a 50% win rate with the Bruiser.
Look, it's not that it's easy mode. It's that the game says that the Bruiser has easy complexity. Like, which means that I think it's the effects of its cards are simple to understand compared to some of the others, like the Spellweaver and the Tinkerer, that are considered hard complexity. I know those both have a couple WAS cards that are essential to how they play, and I know the Spellweaver uses a lot of elements, which is kind of complex in this game.
And then 2 things that I wanted to mention that we talked about during our previous record. In Gloomhaven, they did everything they could to get rid of a die. And now there's a die in Buttons and Bugs. It takes care of a lot of admin, but it also it does affect your attacks. And I think we both mentioned that die is cursed. I did. I had an attack with advantage, and I rolled 2 minuses in a row, and I was really upset about that. So I kept rolling, and then I rolled 7 minuses in a row, and that just shouldn't happen.
You know,
that die is cursed.
I was saying I thought it was maybe weighted. But today when I was playing, I felt like I was rolling a lot of pluses. So previously I felt like I had been rolling a ton of minuses. Today it seemed a little bit more balanced. So maybe I just got lucky today.
Well, hopefully I'll get lucky tonight, because I'm definitely playing after we record.
Nice.
And then the other thing I wanted to mention is the designer of this game, Joe Klipfel. This was originally a print and play on BoardGameGeek. I don't know if you can still get it. I'll have to check. Called Gloomholden. And It was the fever dream of Joe Klipfel. He wanted to play Gloomhaven in his hands without setting anything down. And he managed to do that. There's a video of him playing Gloomholden without putting any cards down. But this the sheer management of what he had to do. He had a card that represented your location on the map that he was sliding around in one hand. He had his cards that he was playing with for his character in the other. And it was insane. This was a fever dream that he had that functioned to the point where we now have Gloomhaven buttons and bugs, which I think is a triumph of design. So to get from point A to point B is a lot for the developer, but also for the dreams of Joe. Way to go, man.
Awesome. I realized also that Nikki Valens, who's the other designer, also worked on Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition. Probably 1st yep. Edition too. But I just noticed that the other day and was like, oh, I recognize that name. So David, who's this game for? Who would enjoy this? Who would hate it?
This is honestly, this game's for me. This is for people who it really is. It's if your favorite part of Gloomhaven was the combat and you can't get a group together to play Gloomhaven, this is for you. It's so quick to set up because it's only using one card as the map. All the other components will fit right on it. I haven't had any problems with bumping and slipping, and I play this in bed. Like I play this in my bed with a flat piece of wood set up on it. So it doesn't take up a ton of space. I've heard people like saying about you could play it on an airplane. I don't think you could play it on an airplane. Those tray tables are too small. But this does not take up a lot of room. So if you're a fan of solo games, if you love the combat system in Gloomhaven, you gotta give this a try. I think you said you could find it like for $20.
Yeah.
Yeah, that price point you just can't beat if what I mentioned is your jam.
So other than Buttons and Bugs, what have you been playing?
There's one other game I've been playing that we're going to talk about in our recurring segment. Board Game Famous Reviews! That's right, we have one final game provided to us by Genius Games, and that is First in Flight. Designed by Matthew O'Malley and Ben Rossett, published by Artana Games. This was provided to us by Genius Games, as is the hallmark of Genius Games. This is a game that's based on a historical setting, so you're going to learn something while you play. And in First in Flight, you are playing as historical figures racing to be the first person to fly a heavier-than-air aircraft. Now, you could play as Orbel and Wilver. I'm so sorry. Is that a capital offense to you, being from Charlotte?
You know, I was really excited about this one because of North Carolina is the First in Flight. Sorry, Ohio, you're wrong.
Yeah, so you could play as Orbel and Wilver or other historical figures. Racing to be the first person to fly your plane, fly your heavier-than-air plane. And what this is, at its heart, is a push-your-luck game where everybody has a deck of cards that they're flipping over cards, trying to not flip over flaws, and just flip over high-numbered cards to get them to fly longer and farther. On your turn, you're going to be moving your pawn along a track to take actions in a ratchet-style mechanism. So that means if you're the farthest behind on the track, you get to move your pawn as far forward as you want. However, if you move your pawn too far forward, people can take multiple actions in a row. And those actions are going to be things like upgrading your engine, getting those higher flight cards into your deck. However, those will also come with additional flaws. You can repair major flaws that you have in your deck and turn them into minor flaws. You can pay money to get equipment, friends, or get skill cards that will help you avoid those flaws and help keep you flying for longer. Or the heart of this game is that flight action where you stop and flip over cards and see how far you can make it before you crash, or hopefully not crash at all. Because once you flip over four flaws, that's when you crash. The game is over after four rounds, or once somebody has a flight that is 40 flights or longer. And after that, everybody gets one more try to go as far as they possibly can. Of the games that Genius Games provided for us, this was the only game that all three of us got to play. So, Jesse, what did you What did you think about First in Flight?
Well, First in Flight was on my list of top 10 games I wanted to play in 2023, so I was very excited about it. It was, I think, my number 3 pick, if I remember correctly, and I have...
Oh, wow, that high.
Yeah, I was really excited about it. It has a lot of things going for it that I enjoy. The first time I played was a solo game, and I thought the solo play was pretty good. I am not a big solo gamer, despite how much I'm enjoying Buttons and Bugs. In general, I'd rather not play games solo. I've tried several of them and usually don't think it's very fun. But that being said, I thought this one, for a learning game, when I wanted to play it by myself before teaching it, I thought the solo mode worked pretty well. I find that the game is generally a lot of fun. As long as everyone else is having a good time, I'm having a good time. I've played it with one person who absolutely did not have a great time. Spoilers, it was Michael. So that first time playing with a group, I didn't have as much fun, but with other groups afterwards, I had a better time. I think one thing Michael disliked about it is that when you take the fly action, everyone else pretty much stops and watches you for however long it takes for you to fulfill that fly action. And I think that kind of builds some intensity and some climax. Michael felt like it was boring and slow. So I think it's a matter of your perspective on how patient you are during other people's turns. The game plays a lot like Takedo in that whoever's furthest back takes their turn and chooses where they're going to go. And you don't usually want to go too far because then you get fewer turns compared to other players. But sometimes you want to make sure you get the one thing you're really wanting to do, whether that's upgrading or repairing flaws or... most often flying when you want to jump ahead, because the game is won when someone, well, the game end is triggered when someone makes a flight distance of 40. And so the only way to do that is by flying. So that is oftentimes what people want to spend their turns doing. In general, I think the game is a lot of fun. I like press your luck games as long as I can go into them saying, like, this is a press your luck game. And if I lose, it's okay. Each player gets to play with a different pilot or a different aviator, a different inventor, and I find that some of them are less balanced compared to others, maybe, in my opinion. Like, there's one who you just get some money at the start of a year, and that doesn't seem very powerful compared to some of the other things that can really boost you. So I think that can make a difference, too. What are your thoughts about the game, David?
I've had a lot of fun with this game. I've also had a lot of highs and a lot of lows, but... I will say this, I was surprised at how much I like First in Flight. It makes me feel things, so one, in any game that elicits an emotional reaction, and especially a positive one, I think is a really good game. I really don't like pressure luck mechanisms. That's one of my least favorite mechanisms. But this game, First in Flight, to me, doesn't feel like a pressure luck game, but rather a mitigate your luck game, where everybody starts with the same basic deck, with the same basic luck, and then most of the actions that you're taking are improving that deck. Sure, you could, like you say in Quacks and Quedlinburg, you're adding better things to your bag. That's improving your bag. It's not, you don't have the control that you have in First in Flight, I feel, because a lot of the skill cards in First in Flight let you look at the top card of your deck, or look at some cards at the top of your flight deck, rearrange them, put basic flaws on the bottom, so you know you're never going to hit those. And that act of mitigating your luck during the flight is a ton of fun. However, that being said, there are a few outlying cases where you can just either know you're never going to win or get too good at it, too good at mitigating your luck that the game loses all its tension and therefore all its fun. So in one instance, one of the persons I was playing with, I gave them one of the player powers that I thought was just reading it felt a little stronger than the others, and that was the player power that when you take the upgrade action, you get to keep better flight cards for your deck with higher numbers. Those are number 2 through 5. That player power was you get to keep an extra one of those flight cards. Instead of the normal 2 that you would get to keep, he gets to keep 3. And first turn of the game, my brother upgraded his engine, took the upgrade action and got 3 4s right off the top of the deck, and I was never going to compete with that, which is a little bit of luck in the game. And then, like you said, that's something you need to go in, like knowing that that could happen. And then the other instance was I was actually playing a solo game. And this one was a really, really outlier instance of whenever you upgrade a design flaw, a major design flaw, you get a special benefit. And 3 of my 4 starting major design flaws were get an upgrade card without a an additional design flaw added to your deck. And then my character's power was when you play an experience card, instead of adding a glide card, you can pay money to add the top card of the upgrade deck. So I was adding a lot of upgrade cards to my deck without having to add design flaws. And then I got enough skills to avoid all the design flaws. And at first I was having a ton of fun manipulating it. And I was like, yes, this is perfect. I'm never going to see a design flaw. Like I'm never going to have a flaw. I'm never going to crash. And then once that happens, you go, oh, there's no tension. I'm just going through the motions every flight action. And it was fine. There was just a little bit of drawback on that. And I do want to state that those two instances were outliers of the game. Other than that, I had a lot of fun playing.
I think in multiplayer, it would be hard to break the game to that extent, because if everyone sees that you've gotten like a bunch of skill cards already, they're going to try to stop you from getting more skill cards.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that I was playing against the autonomous player. I played this game 3 times solo, which you said the solo mode was okay. I thought it was really good. I thought it was fairly good. The highest praise for me for a solo game is I go back to playing it. I play it more than once, and I played it 3 times. So once is a learning game, and then twice is like, I'm just going to play First in Flight again. This is a lot of fun.
Cool.
Yeah, I really liked First in Flight. It was good. I don't want to say of the three, it was probably my favorite. I don't know. It's hard to compare First in Flight to Ecosystem Savannah because they're two very different games. But yeah, I was really happy that I played. Really happy that I got to play First in Flight. Like the previous games before this, First in Flight has been donated to Village Meeple, my local board game cafe here in Springfield, Missouri. If you are in the area, definitely go in and give it a chance. It's a lot of fun to play. If you are not in the area, check out Genius Games. I've been meaning to link them in below. I think I will do that for this episode and then go back to the last two and put their links in. So check out Genius Games online. Besides the three that they provided, Genius Games has a ton of really fun games. I personally have Cytosis and Cellulose. Check out their catalog. They've got a lot of fun games. A huge shout out to Genius Games one more time for providing these review copies. Thank you so much. I did forget one thing.
What did you forget?
You mentioned that Michael does not like this game. And he happens to have a copy sitting around his house because he won a copy from Tantrum Con. Now, I believe he's okay to part with that. So, we're going to have a contest for a copy of First in Flight. Two ways to enter. You can either email boardgamefamous@gmail.com. Just say that one more time, boardgamefamous@gmail.com. Put in the header First in Flight and email us a question for our mail time. Just any old board game question that we can answer. And you'll be entered into a chance to win Michael's copy of First in Flight. The other chance to enter is if you go to our post on Instagram that will be up by the time that this podcast goes live. Go ahead and give that post a like and comment on it, and then we will I'll make sure that you're entered in for a chance to win Michael's copy of First in Flight. I think I will say a caveat of I'm only going to mail this to the 48 lower states, the 48 contiguous states. This is not sponsored by Genius Games because it's Michael's personal copy, so I will be paying for shipping. But hey, if you email us a question or go to that Instagram post and like it, you could have your own copy. And I think we'll give everybody a full fortnight to enter the contest.
Sounds like a plan. Good luck, everybody.
And now it's time for Brother Talk, the part of the podcast where we talk about whatever we're feeling like. And this time, I wanted to talk about the meta game, or a game's meta, which is how you play the game. And not do you play by the rules or are you following the rules, but the patterns and strategies that players use within the confines of those board games' rules. Does that make sense?
No. Explain it to me like I'm in kindergarten. ChatGPT could do it. Here, I'm going to go to ChatGPT right now. Explain the concept of metagaming, modern tabletop board games, to me like I am 10 years old. Okay, here's what it says. All right, imagine you're playing a really cool board game with your friends. In this game, everyone has their own pieces, and they're trying to win by making smart moves and decisions. But sometimes, instead of just playing the game and having fun, someone might try to use information from outside the game to help them win. In tabletop board games, metagaming might involve knowing things about the game that your characters or pieces wouldn't know, like what strategies other players are likely to use, or
I'm cutting this out. I disagree with this definition. That's not the correct definition of metagaming. That might be metagaming, but a game's meta is something else. It's mostly prevalent in trading
Social
card
deduction
games.
games? Oh,
So
okay.
it's heavily prevalent in social deduction games, but it's how people play the game based on rules. Based on the rule sets, and it's the patterns and behaviors that a group will fall into. For example, I play Dominion, and everybody that I play Dominion with trashes all their cards as quickly, as fast as they can, if there's a cheap trasher out there. You don't have to, but that's how everybody I play with plays. Does that make sense?
Kinda.
A more concrete example I have is the game Coimbra, which is about dice drafting. So on your turn, you can draft one of four colors of dice. Two of them give you resources, one of them gives you straight victory points, and then one gives you this nebulous pilgrim movement off on a track on the side. Where I come from, in St. Louis, everybody drafts the resource dice as fast as possible. And then I moved to Springfield, and they had a completely different way of playing the same game with the same rules. They fought for the green dice and the purple dice for the straight points and the pilgrim movement. And I destroyed them. So I disrupted their meta because they were all fighting for one specific type of dice because that's how this group plays the game. And it's all perfectly legal. It's all within the rules. Another example I have is in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is a game that is largely considered to be solved. There's some nebulousness with one of the expansions having more buildings rotating out, so it's not a set start. But if you play with experienced Puerto Rico players, they will get mad at you if you make the wrong move because you're not following the meta of the game.
This sounds like when my brother tried to teach my family bridge, and he was like, "Oh, you have to bid this particular way, and if you don't, you're doing it wrong." It's not very fun.
exactly. Exactly. And meta can be rough. Meta can be rough, and meta can be mean. But it also allows you to predict what your other player, what your opponents are going to do. If you know the strategies that your opponents like to employ within a game, then you can block them and stop them easier. Not just looking at what they have currently, like, oh, they obviously need stone. You could think, they like to go for this type of building. I'm going to block the stone now. And that's what the meta is. In terms of trading card games, there are considered to be meta viable decks in the sense that you get these specific cards in your deck if you want to win. And there's usually four or five different deck variants that you can play with that are viable. And that's what the meta is. So even though trading card games have pools of like tens of thousands of cards, they're not going to be playing with tens of thousands of cards, and you can know this because you know the meta.
Do you play with a meta deck from Lorcana?
I do not. Not normally, at
Why
least.
not?
Because they're boring. A downside of playing to the meta is being predictable. And oftentimes you don't want to be predictable within board games.
But isn't it efficient?
It can be, but if it's predictable, it's bad. Right? If you're playing a head-to-head board game and you're predictable, you're not gonna win.
Maybe.
And that's interesting because that's actually how computers versus people in chess. One of the things that human players realized is that computers would play the optimal move, and great chess players would know what the optimal move is, so they would set up a trap for the optimal move. So they had to program suboptimal moves into chess computing.
It's complicated.
It is complicated, and so playing too much of the meta is about being m making sure you're not being predictable in games. Was this too esoteric of a topic?
It's kind of obscure. Like, we usually talk in our groups, we usually talk about the metagame within the context of social deduction games. For instance, there's this one guy, Jeff, who, if he and I are getting along during a social deduction game, we're probably on opposite teams. But if we are not getting along, we're probably on the same team.
And then that would be the meta. That is the pattern of how you guys play.
It's how we figure it out. But then once we realized that we were doing that, then we had to change it up. In general, I have found that during games like Avalon, there are some things that are considered optimal, and if you don't do them, you're doing it wrong. Like the way that you vote for or against missions. So if you don't know Avalon, it's a many-player social deduction game where some of you are on the side of King Arthur and some of you are against King Arthur, and you're trying to succeed on missions. And in general, you want to put, if you're on the good team, if you're on the King Arthur team, you want to put good people on the quest to make it pass. And part of the meta is if you're not on the quest, you probably are going to vote against it because you know you are good, and therefore you should not approve of a quest you're not on. But eventually you have to approve of the quest.
I 100% agree with that rule. I'm glad to know we have the same meta for that.
It isn't always fun. It's one of the reasons I don't love that game.
Oof.
Hot takes. So do you think the more you play a game, the more you understand its meta?
No, honestly, what I think it is, the more you play a game with the same people is how you fall into those patterns. That's how you develop a meta. And you don't realize it until you play with other people. Another example I have of this is Michael really doesn't like Blood Rage. He rightfully thinks the Loki strategy is easy. And it is. It is easy if nobody else drafts those Loki cards. But for my game group, the meta evolved to making sure those Loki cards are split up and not one player has all of them. And that's just how our game group plays the game. I guess that's a good definition. The meta, how you play a game within the rules of that game.
Any other thoughts on it?
Don't be too predictable when you play. Switch up your strategies. A truly great game will have multiple paths to victory. So mix it up. And when you do mix it up, the game might surprise you. It might be a more enjoyable experience.
Nah, play basic. Do the same thing every time. Be a robot.
Not a chance. And that brings us to the end of another podcast. Thanks for listening. If you want to reach out to us, you can always email us at boardgamefamous@gmail.com. Most shout-outs for our email in a podcast yet. You can also find us on Instagram using the link below. Or join our Discord, join our conversation, you also using the link below. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all!
Oh, I stole your exit.
That's okay. I'll be Michael. Bye.